And who can tell me what Joshua 24:15 says?
I have it here if you'd like me to read it.
Please.
If it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord.
Okay. So Joshua, very often we look at him and his declaration there to the children of Israel, and really a challenge to the children of Israel about who they're going to serve, who they're going to believe in, what worldview are they going to have, how are they going to conduct their families, things like that. And when he says, me and my house, of course, he's talking about those in his household, his wife, his children, perhaps some servants who served under him. But whoever would be within that household, he's saying, we are going to serve the Lord. There's a determined focus and a decision that has been made. This is where we stand. Sometimes you see this posted in people's homes. Sometimes you see it over a threshold when you enter into their home or somewhere prominent where they've made that declaration, just as Joshua did. We know that the family is a basic unit in society. It's really a foundation for all other relationships that there are in any really group or organization that you would have. It's true when you're talking about a nation. It's true when you're talking about a church. The families are the basic unit within that church. And question number one, I had asked, why did God create the family? Let's go ahead and turn to Psalm 127. Let's notice verse 3 here. Psalm 127, verse 3. Who will read that for us? Go ahead.
Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward.
Okay. Why did God create the family?
Well, I started back in Genesis when he said it wasn't good for man to be alone. Then he instituted marriage with a husband and a wife, and then they were to be fruitful and multiply. So it was for the benefit of each member of that family to have a family unit.
Okay, that's the key right there. For the benefit of mankind, it's good. Families are good for mankind. They're good for society. What did Satan do, since you mentioned not good for man to be alone, what did Satan do right at the start?
Well, he tried to cause a division in the family, did actually cause a division, but it didn't divide the man and woman. It divided the couple from God.
Okay, divided them from God. When God confronted Adam, what did he do?
He blamed his wife.
The woman you gave me. You know, okay, so the Bible doesn't record it for us, but I'm just wondering what Eve had to say to Adam later. You know, wait a second, buddy. So there, he was attempting to drive that wedge. Adam was tempted not just to eat the fruit, but then to say, well, Eve's the reason that it's her fault. You know, pointing that finger, Zach.
Just noting that the serpent, Satan, tempted Eve individually. He didn't approach Eve and Adam. He must have been nearby and she was able to come and say, hey, look, check this fruit out. So he approached Eve when she was alone and not together with the strength of her husband. Or if Adam had been the one tempted, he would have been tempted when Satan knew he was away from Eve, alone from the strength of that unit. So just an observation, I guess, that It's when we're alone and separated from our family, whether that's by blood or by Jesus' blood, we're more susceptible to falling into sin.
He definitely tries to isolate us. And there are times when, even if we're together, he can tempt us and he can try us in those things, but he definitely would prefer to have us isolated because, one of the illustrations about the devil is a roaring lion, and lions like to get their prey isolated and to be able to attack them. So Satan is going to attack the family because God put the family in place as a benefit to man. And the devil realizes if I can attack and destroy the family, that does make everybody more vulnerable to his wiles, if you will. And if we allow the world to shape our view and understanding of the home and family, it will affect our relationship to one another. It's going to happen. It's going to undermine our relationship to God. And so we have to guard our families, and we need to build our families up because he will attack. It's going to be relentless. So question two, I'd ask you to define family. Now, before we do that, before you give me your answers on that, I'm going to ask the question. Some of you may say, well, you're asking the same thing. But just go along with me. When you think of home, what do you think of? Okay, where your family is?
Sanctuary.
Home can be sometimes a place to sleep and rest. We think about a physical structure, a place of emotional support and security, place of appreciation. What else can the home be? Home can be chaotic, right? A home can be a place where people let their guard down. They behave differently in public. They behave differently at work than they do at home. At work, they've got it all reined in real tight because, you know, it's really important. If you fly off the handle at your boss, guess what? You're looking for another job. Or you fly off the handle to the wrong person, you got a face full of knuckles coming at you. Whereas at home, I can get away with that. Especially if I'm the big guy at home. And nobody gonna push me around here, right? People let their guard down. So their tongue, their temper, temptations can run rampant and wild at home. Chris?
Well, it's a place of love. It's a place of
supposed to be. Yep.
And it's also a place of encouragement. As God created family, creating man as the hierarchy in the family, it still doesn't mean that the man and woman, the husband and wife, does not work together as one.
Yes.
To resolve issues that come around at all times.
Yes, they are
constantly uplifting each other and helping each other.
That's the ideal home. And later in our studies, we're going to talk about that marriage relationship. Sometimes a home is, somebody looks at it as, well, that's a place where I'm pampered and I'm catered to and I'm served. So purely a selfish type of thing. Now, specifically to family, define family. Did anybody look it up in a dictionary? Family. What is family?
Descendants of common ancestors.
Okay, yeah, that's one of the descendants of common ancestors, right? You're blood related. I don't know if I've mentioned this before. I'm adopted. And so several years ago I did DNA, but a couple years ago a half sister popped up, and then all of a sudden I found out I got this spider web of half brothers and half sisters all over the place. It's ridiculous. So now me and the one half sister, we consider each other family. The rest of those heathens, we don't consider family. We're just No, you know. But yeah, very commonly, the people that are you're genetically related to, you're descendant from, you look at that, that's family. Any other definitions you came up with?
We often include those who were not blood relatives as family, like our spouse. I'm a blood relative to Heather, but we refer to each other as the family unit. In our family, it's her and I and her children, even though my blood relation with her is not by physical blood between us. It's I always refer to Jesus' blood unites us.
Right. You share children, though. You know... You have the children together. That ties you together. Like me, I was adopted into a family. So I consider them family. Mom and dad and the sister I grew up with, they're family. So there's those definitions we look at as we tie people together, if you will. One of the definitions I saw is a group of people united by certain convictions or a common affiliation, a basic unit of society, traditionally consisting of two parents rearing their own or adopted children, and so on and so forth. Now, in our day and age, they're pushing further and further into this of what they think of as family. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis 2, let's do what Nancy did. Go back to the beginning. And in Genesis 2:18, this is where God said, "It is not good for a man to be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." And so, of course, what does he do? Do what?
Makes woman.
Makes woman, makes Eve, right? And what's the declaration in verse 24? Yes, she is. And right before that.
Man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife.
Okay. Man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife. That is family. Right, that's the family unit when you think about it. That's the original husband, wife. They're brought together. They are joined together by God. That is family. Now, family may or may not have children. And this definition, as we're looking at this, the husband and wife, they may or may not have children. Remember, Abraham and Sarah for a long time did not have children together, but they were family. They were husband and wife. So this is what God is looking at as here's that basic unit of relationship to another human being of husband and wife. That's where it all started. Now, you flip it around and how are people trying to redefine family now?
A common declaration for that is the phrase, love is love.
Love is love.
It does not matter.
Meaning what?
Two men can have it start a family. Love is love.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, for those who are old enough, Anita.
Yeah, it's like you talked about Webster. You just look at the definition of how they put it. They took a male and female out of it. It's two parents. You know,
exactly.
Leaves it wide open to them. There's no gender.
Exactly. Yes, two parents, two parental units. Those who are old enough, back in the 60s and into the 70s, hippies had what were called communes. And in a hippie commune, it was not uncommon for various men to sleep with various women, and then they all have a bunch of children in there, and they have a bunch of moms, and they have a bunch of dads. Now, that's back when they still understood that's a male, that's a female. Now, we've gotten to the point of, you know, these two parents, they have two parents, but now there's people who advocate, well, we have a three-way relationship. There's two men here and one woman, or two women and one man. And they say, well, that I have three parents. I mean, they have completely gone off or gone away from how the Bible shows us it was originally established. Here's a man, here's a woman. And then if they have children, you know, you got mother and father and son or daughter or sons and daughters. But now you can be unmarried, unrelated whatsoever. It's just a big mixed up group of whoever you want to say is your family. Well, that's not what we read about in the Bible. It's very clear. You have a man, you have a woman, they're joined together, and then they would have children in that relationship. That really is the Bible saying, here's what a family really is. Any other thoughts? Zach?
I thought it was always strange growing up, but my dad would remind me and my sister several times, we love you, but you are an extension of our family. And he meant it so lovingly. He was joking, I think, most of the time he said it. But he made a point to instill in me and my sister that they're the ones who have the marriage, and that's the priority for the two of them. And we we felt loved all the time, but we were reminded from time to time that we are an extension. And it makes a little bit more sense now that I have children.
Right, right. Who is it who's actually going to run this household, and who makes decisions, and who is it that has the authority and the lead, and where's the priority in the relationship between the husband and wife? Yeah, those types of things. You know, there's evil forces in modern times that are trying to alter the definition of family and marriage. Of course, we all know about, you know, various rulings. In the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruling, I think it was, they said marriage is an evolving paradigm. Talks about the voluntary union of two persons as spouses to the exclusion of all others. Of course, that's really old school now, the way that they're talking about those things. But there are people who marry their pets. Literally, they marry their animals. They've gone through ceremonies. There's polyamory, where multiple people in that relationship might be two men, three women. It could be a whole bunch. The duration of the relationship, you know, come and go, easy divorce, easy remarriage, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of those things that are happening as a result of the breakdown just simply of the definition of marriage and what it really means, and getting away from the biblical pattern of that. So the family is in danger. It's because it is under attack. Now, let me ask you something. Question three I'd ask, what is threatening the family? And ask you to provide scripture references that show things that undermine the family, which we'll get to those scripture references in a minute. But before we get into those scripture references, do you have anything that you see that's threatening the family? It's a danger to it. Government. How's the government doing it? Okay. Yeah. Any other thoughts on that? What's been in the news the past few months and really determined the election outcome in Virginia? Does anybody watch news? I mean, I don't watch news, but I knew this was going on. Remember the schools, and you had the transgender bathroom issue, and it came out, oh, they had rapes of a boy acting like he was a girl, went in the girl's bathroom, raped a girl, and multiple occasions of that, and the curriculum that's being taught in some of those schools, some of the things that's involved there. And, you know, it's just come out today that parents who are protesting that are being marked as terrorists. They're being watched and tracked by the FBI. So you cannot tell me the government is not an enemy of the family.
Yeah,
It is. It is absolutely doing its very best. I know these cases we could say, well, that's an isolated case. But you look at parents who I know since I've had my children. Now, I will tell you this. It hasn't affected my behavior. But I know ever since I've had children, I've heard of cases where, you know, little Johnny got out of line at Walmart and his mama popped him. And next thing you know, CPS is showing up at her door. Child Protective Services, hey, you can't do that. So we have a real problem where our political system, our government, has a different understanding about family, what family is, what it means, who has authority, who has the right. This flows in from government into school systems and thinking that they have authority over the children versus the parents. Andrew, you have something?
Just want to say it's kind of, if you look in history, it's one of the things we looked at in my more recent law school is actually that it's a fairly recent phenomenon. If you look at human history, that government even became involved in marriage. It wasn't until really the British Empire decided, hey, we can tax licenses, that they even got involved. Because before that, it was always a religious ceremony or the town that did it.
Right. It was a cultural understanding and compact more than it was on the government side of things. Yeah. Ron.
As you're describing this, even under social justice standards, it's entering into the curriculum of schools where you have this social equality, you know, emotional equality. And it is looking at, you know, how to deal with transgenders because it's under discrimination. And so, you know, it's all perversion that is being taught to people, you know, as you're describing this. And we have in our culture, unfortunately, social intellectualism, in which there are a group that believe they have the understanding and they're the ones that are being influential in government, particularly in certain political parties, that's swaying these decisions that are coming right down through the school systems.
Yeah, and there's a huge problem that's behind all of it is basically these people are humanists.
Yes.
They're atheists. They don't believe in God. They don't believe in the Bible. And so they're using their human wisdom on these things. And it's coming like a tidal wave against people who believe in the biblical definition, understanding of family, marriage, and all that. John?
When you look at a biblical example of the breakdown of the home, you can go back to Genesis and look at Lot. He became homeless. He lost his wife, became a widower, and he became the father of the enemies of God's people, all because he selfishly looked out and saw a fertile valley and said, that's where I'm going. And then when God told him to get up and leave, he dragged his feet and wouldn't do it because he was comfortable. So that the root there is selfishness. He was very selfish from the start and continued to be selfish, and it ruined his family.
Well, one of the big things, as anyone with children knows, that children pretty well obliterate selfishness, or your family's just a wreck. If parents are selfish, the family's a wreck. The children live in abusive circumstances, whether that's abuse by neglect or actual verbal, physical abuse, because the parents are selfish. But be that as it may. Question three, then. Biblical answers or biblical references to things that undermine the family. What do we got? How about easy marriage divorce or easy divorce and remarriage? Right? Matthew 19:9. If there's easy divorce and remarriage, what does that do for a family? What does that do for the children? Right? Parents get over that easier than the children do when they have those kinds of problems. What else? Anything else going after the family?
So you had Sodom and Gomorrah and Gideon, and Benjamin, and late judges. This stuff ain't new.
Benjamin. No, it's not new. It's not new. It's what we're facing now. Yes, Sodom and Gomorrah. So that understanding of, you know, there's a natural sexual relationship between a man and a woman and unnatural. Two men, two women.
I was thinking about in Matthew 13 about the seed that gets choked out. And it's kind of a weird connection, but just the cares of the world will distract the family. I noted 1 John 2:16, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life. Things that draw our attention as individual members of a family away from each other and more towards trends and being consumed by technology. You know, there's balances that need to be established with the cares of the world so that we don't pull ourselves away from the family.
Okay, so two things that you mentioned, or I'll redefine them here. Materialism and worldliness, right? Looking at material things, that's what I follow, pursue after. That undermines the family. Worldliness, which would encompass a whole lot of things. One of those things would be entertainment. A lot of the entertainment in our society, 1 Corinthians 15:33 says what? Yeah, evil company corrupts good morals. So we sit there and we soak all of that in, and it becomes normalized, and our children grow up. If they're watching these things, it becomes normal for people to cohabit. Oh, that's just, you know, and look at what a fun life they have. And they're all cohabiting together. Nobody's married, but they're cohabiting.
Look, it's a very subtle desensitization of a society.
Right. Right.
And that's been going on.
Yeah, I'm going to return to that. Remind me, Andrew.
Just one thing on society, going back and it's Gibeon, not Gibeon. But one of the sad things from that incident, I'm not sure that you can't draw the same parallel to our modern world, that supposedly our civilization was based on Judeo-Christianity principles. But that couple would have been safer if they did listen to the sermon and went into Jerusalem, into the city of, instead of going to Gibeon.
Hmm.
And that's sad.
Yeah, thinking about these threats, one of the big threats, you know, works of the flesh. It talks about adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, which within those categories, pornography. Pornography is wreaking havoc in families. Because of course, the immorality of it, the breaking down of the relationship between the husband and wife, and things that are getting into the minds of young men and young women. Young women are not immune to that issue. Gambling. Gambling can be a huge issue. How does that affect a family? What's that? Financially, going into debt, bankruptcy, fights, arguments over all those kinds of things. And religious compromise, the acceptance of divorce. When I was growing up, going through the school system, it was not uncommon for us to know someone whose parents were divorced and, you know, they had a stepmom or a stepdad and things like that. In my mother's generation, those people were not talked about. Those people who had been divorced, they were outcast in society. In my day and age, divorce was normal. Now, what are our children facing? What's normal?
No marriage.
A guy in high heels. That's normal. They, oh yeah, you know. It's... And I'm not sure if you don't have children out there, they're seeing these things, they're facing these things. You know, when I was in high school, a homosexual, if it was even suspected someone was a homosexual, they were terribly abused and shunned and talked about and everything else like that. Now, they're some of the leading people in school. They get voted as, you know, the popular kid. It has completely changed. And that's something that Nancy mentioned, the desensitization to what people are offended over, what bothers them, what troubles them. Nowadays, you know, don't be surprised, some of you here, if your grandchildren don't see anything wrong or what the big deal is about some transgender person, you know, being there at the birthday party. It just won't affect them. They won't think of it that way, Zach. And then
I think it falls under the category of tolerance as well. I think that was part of the issue Paul's addressing in 1 Corinthians 5, the man who had his father's wife. They were doing nothing about it because it was likely being influenced by culture as well. And the church was reprimanded by Paul for not having dealt with that. And we can become tolerant in our families about sin and relationships we have with the neighbors, with family we worship with. And in Romans 1:32, it uses the phrase giving hearty approval to those who practice them. So not just talking, teaching our children against those things, but making sure that we don't allow conversation or modes of entertainment that tolerate it as well, like you mentioned.
Andrew, real quick, then Anita.
Just an observation, having had to spend a little over a decade in higher ed, the change was a lot faster than we remember.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you over a 4-year period, it went from you barely even heard just about homosexuality to transgenderism, something was becoming the new promoted.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been at lightning speed. It has been. Anita, and then right.
And there's no line mark about any of it. Well, I mean, they're adults. They're adults. You know, that's what you hear so much. And then even in the church, even I know, like, here, you know, everybody takes a stand against divorce. They take a stand against homosexuality and all this kind of stuff until it affects their family. And then when it affects their family, oh, well, maybe that's not what the Bible meant. That's not what God meant. That's my son. That's my daughter.
Right.
So I personally have been struggling with, my daughter has been withdrawn from. She's living in sin. She continues to live in sin. And I do not fellowship her. And I'm looked at as, I can't believe you turn your own back on your own child. Now, I mean, because when we fellowship that and we embrace that, we're embracing them in their sin is how I see it. If I see it wrong, please help me understand that. Because it's not, oh, all of a sudden it's in your face. It's little by little.
Yeah.
And with her, I've tried, and I keep thinking, you know, Lord, man, you know, that's me. That's my fail. But it's like, you try to be that little voice once in a while, you know, but I can see that she's very content as long as she, you know, has a little bit of contact and things like that. I just, you know, that's something that I struggle with all the time with that. But it's not something that just happens all of a sudden.
Yeah, there's something eating away there that grows and grows and grows inside of them, and there are little indications along the way, and then, boom, it's there. It's out in the open.
As Christians, too, I mean, you know, we profess to be Christians. I mean, we need to be aware of that. You know, the Bible's not there. The Word has not changed. It's like you said, it's our minds and our hearts that have changed.
Right, exactly right. This standard's consistent, has been.
Thinking about the desensitizing of society, it's something that Satan's using, the humanist agenda, and absolutely tearing down in a process. If you look back at the Humanist Manifesto, ran into that recently, and you see from 1930-something, the original thing, you see things that it's talked about there that has happened over the years, and it's been put in place, and they've gone into the schools and put their agenda in place, and it's gone from the schools into the churches and beyond.
Yes, exactly right. So on the toleration side of things, one of the problems has been that churches have tolerated these things. They've tolerated, first of all, they tolerated adulterous marriages. And they thought, well, it's still a man and a woman. So they just, church, and I'm saying churches in general in our society. And then you saw where they were tolerating people who were shacking up. And now they're tolerating homosexuals and transgender people. And I hate even using that term because there is no, you are what you are. There's no trans, there's no, anyway. So they're tolerating all of that now. And there's not been a bulwark against this movement. And we have to be, in the church, we have to stand against these things and stand firm on biblical principles. No matter what kind of pressure, no matter what is said about us, how we're characterized, we have to take a stand. So in the church, churches of Christ, some of you who are older, who have been in churches of Christ through your life, or maybe you know about your parents, your grandparents mentioning these things, it used to be, you did not know a divorced member of the church. You didn't. It didn't happen because they were firm being married for life. And whatever problems happened in that marriage, they were staying married. That was it. But now it's not uncommon to have divorced people among churches of Christ because it's it's grown in society, proliferated is what I was trying to get out. And so it's naturally going to be something that affects churches. So you see children falling away. You see parents falling away. You see entire families falling away. Young people who are courting or dating and marrying the wrong people. That's just the way that goes. Young people going off to college but not going to church when they go off to college. All those things are happening among churches of Christ. Nancy, do you have something?
Well, just in the threat to the family is the warning in Judges 2:10. There arose a generation that didn't know God. And that is the biggest threat to the home. Because the government's going to do, I don't care what government in the world it is, it's going to do what it's going to do. It's knowing God in the home and reverencing God is the only thing that saves the family.
Proverbs 22:6. Let's just jump right there. Question number 4. What is one aspect of the family that makes it important? Proverbs 22:6. Who will read that for us? Go ahead, Chris.
Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from
it. Okay. It's important. Why? What's the thing that's really focused on here?
The training.
The training. Let's be really specific. Let's break this out here. Training of?
Oh, a child. It has to start at the very beginning with the child.
Has to start at the beginning. What's that child going to do? That child is going to grow up. A child is going to go out in society and have an impact on society. And if they're not trained right, they're going to have the wrong impact. They're going to go the wrong way. Rick?
Even if they walk away from the truth, that's always going to be embedded in their brain, and it's going to eat at them, and hopefully it will eat at them to the point they will come back.
That's the hope. That's the hope. So the training beginning in the home, you teach them morality. Right? Then they carry that worldview with them when they go to school, when they go out into the workforce, when they're around friends on the weekends or whenever it may be. You train them in that morality, and then they're a beacon of that morality. Zach?
And the end game, thankfully, isn't that they're a good impact to society. The end game is that they've been trained so that they are entered into heaven. As we're judged individually, you've given them that training, yes, to be a good citizen and a faithful member of the local church and leader of their own family or whatever their roles are, but training them up so that they go to heaven.
Yes, that is the ultimate goal. When we train them upright in the home, they're going to understand about authority, respecting authority. They respect the authority of the parents. You instill in them a respect for the authority of God, which will help them and be an impact when they go out into the workforce and in the society in which they live. You teach them, as Zach was just talking about, the religious truth, what it is to worship God and honor God and what He expects of them in their life. All kinds of things that start right there in the home. And if we get away from God's pattern in this, it eats away at it. It undermines it. And you see what's happening in our society where it's been undermined for a very long time. Things are breaking down very badly. And if we're not actively teaching morals and religion and authority in our home, the world is definitely teaching our children. And it's going to have a greater impact on them if we are not actively doing that in our homes.
Stephen, it's very important that we do this for our children. As Zach is pointing out, we're shepherding our children's heart until they can give that heart to God. Because God tells us when we're adults, we're still disciplined. And if we're not disciplined when we're kids, then we're not going to be able to handle the discipline that He gives us when we're adults. Because the writer of Hebrews in chapter 12, I believe it is, says, you know, what son is there who is not disciplined by his father?
Yep.
In explaining the reason that we're disciplined as adults. So to handle the discipline that we receive as adults, we need to have been disciplined as children if we're not. And so all this that we're talking about, the divorce and the homosexual, it's all a lack of discipline in people's lives because we didn't get it when we were young.
Respect for authority and discipline to follow that authority is exactly right. So question 5. List reasons and Bible references for why there is hope for the family. As we've talked about doom and gloom, everything's falling apart. Zach.
Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3. All the families of the earth through Abraham would be blessed. So God promised that long, long ago. All families following and obeying the Lord would be blessed. So He set that up.
Okay, yeah. Anybody else?
Just on the cultural side, if we think this is new, look at Corinthians. And there was an active church there, and there was still being letters sent to. They had, we're dealing with these problems, but it ain't new. But it doesn't mean it has to last.
Yep. Anybody else? What have you got?
We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to Christ.
Romans 8, I think it was. Yeah. Andrew said a while ago, this is nothing new. We read Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve, they ate the fruit. Genesis chapter 4, what happens? Yeah. One brother murders another brother. What happens in toward the end of Genesis chapter 5 and really the beginning of Genesis chapter 6? What are we told? I mean, it's just like boom, boom, boom. Thoughts of man's hearts continually evil, full of violence, wickedness. So much so that God said, I'm wiping you all out except for these. All right. Who made it through that? Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their wives. Can you have a godly family in a wicked and corrupt world? You know, because sometimes people say, oh, I'm not even sure it's worth having children. Not even sure. I understand that feeling. But you know, you can raise a godly family in a wicked world. A family that stands out and is different. A family that if there was a flood today, they would survive that flood. because you trained them, you taught them, you instilled the truth in them, a love, a respect for God. That is possible.
Well, a verse that I think offers hope is in, well, verses Hebrews 10, 23 through 25.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. So we have a hope. We have someone who promised that is faithful to keep that promise. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner some is, but exhorting one another and so much more as you see the day approaching. So there is the family unit, and then there is God's family unit. And that, you know, that is what is going to get us through all of this, the assembling of ourselves together.
He brought us together to reinforce our faith, that it starts in that home, and then we come together as God's people to help build each other up in the faith to have that hope of heaven. Now, you look at Noah, look at Abraham, look at Samuel, Zechariah, and Elizabeth, who raised John, that, you know, even though it was a Jewish society that believed in God, they were wicked and corrupt. So it is possible. We understand it doesn't mean they're perfect. Abraham was not perfect. Noah wasn't perfect. Ham, his son, was not perfect. But we understand people can serve God even though the world is given to wickedness. And we can help our family serve him so that ultimate goal is reached, that we get to heaven. All right, we are out of time. Lord willing, we'll go on to that next lesson next week and continue to study about home and family.